Welcome to the Defence Forces podcast, brought to you by the Defence Forces Public Relations Branch.
Hello and welcome to the Irish Defence Forces podcast. My name is Captain Cian Clancy, and today we're speaking to Lieutenant Austin Doyle and Sergeant Valerie Cole about the European Union training mission to Mali and their experiences training the Malian Armed Forces. Welcome on to the show, guys. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, sir. How are you?
So, first of all, your own kind of broad backgrounds. We might start with you, Ozzy. So, how long have you been in Defence Forces? Where are you from?
I'm from Naas in Kildare. I started my cadetship in September 16, commissioned 18 into, commissioned January 18 into the NCO training wing. So, still in the NCO training wing at the moment. Okay. That's my full extent of my military career today.
You're new enough into the organisation.
Yeah.
And Mali was your first overseas experience?
First trip, yeah. So I suppose something I didn't think I'd be doing 10 years ago, going to Africa with the Defence Forces. Luck of the draw, I got a good one to start with.
Yeah, in fairness. And what about yourself, Valerie?
So I'm originally from Leitrim, sir. I joined the Defence Forces in 2004. I'm currently 16 years in. And I spent most of my career in training units. So I spent 7 years in the BTC in Dublin, and then I spent another 2 years in the NCO training wing, where LT Doyle is currently now. Three overseas tours, of one to Chad, 2009. I was recently in UNDOF, 2017, and my most recent one then was Mali there last year.
So this was, but it wasn't your first African experience, obviously.
No, sir. Second, yeah.
Fantastic, 100%. And as you said, you're both in the NCO training wing now at the moment.
Well, currently I'm in the G7 in the HQ in the DFC.
Right, so the training aspect.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So, again, so for yourself, Ozzy, must have been kind of a real sort of, I don't know what to expect, but you obviously had African experience before. How was it kind of set up for Mali?
We kind of had a form-up in UNSI.
We had a training school in
the corridor. I had a classmate on the trip with me as well, so that was good. It was the first trip for both of us.
Yeah.
And we get on quite well. So, and there's only 20 of us between the HQ elements and the training. So it was a small group, three excellent training sergeants was available, but a lot of experience, so it was great to have that around as well. And everyone on the trip had two minimum trips, I suppose. So for myself and LT Harrison, we had lots of experience.
Lots of support, yeah.
Kind of telling us what it was going to be like, as much as they knew from overseas as well.
A lot of experience in drawing.
So we had 4 weeks there, and then we had about 2 weeks leave before going. And then we went over in September 19.
So we arrived.
You're paying attention there.
Yeah, we arrived the 17th of March in Kulikoro. So that's the training area. Yeah.
Okay.
And then we came back in September last year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's all kind of relatively quite fresh in the mind.
Yeah.
Always good. So I suppose for people at home who might know what, say, the Malian situation is and what the makeup of EUT in Mali is, can you give us kind of a breakdown on, like, what is the situation in Mali in recent years?
The mission's gone on since 2013. Mm-hmm. So in 2012, I think it was March 2012, there was a coup d'etat over there. The Malian government requested help from the European Union. So the mission started then 2013, with the HQ being set up, and then the training mission set up, essentially to help the Malian armed forces stabilize the country, train them to I suppose, be better equipped with their TTPs, their tactics, techniques, and procedures, we've heard. And how to stabilize the country, because a lot of conflicts kind of northern Mali.
I suppose from a geopolitical situation, you have a fundamentalist Islamist militia which is operating in the northern half of the country and causing instability. And I suppose it's very important to have a strong Malian state to try and stabilize the country and prevent atrocities occurring and instability and damaging the economy of Mali and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so North Mali would be quite poor, be all like cultural kind of, the capital is Bamako down south. Mm-hmm. Timbuktu is about, it is North Mali, but if you look on the map, it's kind of about halfway up the country, just a bit over halfway, maybe along the River Niger. So that's kind of the most northern city.
Yeah.
But most of the government is based down south, I suppose. So people in northern Mali would probably feel a bit detached, maybe.
Okay.
From the capital, or the kind of be a long way away from where the capital is, and probably that's where the support would come from.
Yeah, of course. If you feel kind of quite isolated, maybe feel very different culturally speaking. So I suppose what I'd written here is, like, why is it important to train the Malian army to a high level? And we've kind of answered that question, is that a stable Mali means it's a stable region, which is better for the lives of the people there and better for the kind of development of the country and improving economic conditions and what have you. So we're going to go in a little bit of detail as we go along about what is involved in training Malian soldiers and also the cultural differences. But as regards the mission itself, what kind of other nations are participating?
So within the EU to answer, there was 23 different countries from the EU, and then there was 5 non-EU countries as well. And out of all those countries, we were all divided into teams. So it wasn't just necessarily an Irish team or a Spanish team or a German team. We all mixed. So you'd have a platoon commander, and then you'd have maybe 5 different nationalities. So it was a good way of kind of getting to know the other nationalities and see what way they work, but at the same time, we were all there to deliver the same instruction that was governed by, say, the syllabus set out, and everybody, regardless of kind of what your background was, we deliver the same kind of training. As such. So there was a good kind of skill set. So with the likes of courses and stuff, I know primarily it would have been infantry training, but there was also a lot of different courses. And I suppose a good way of kind of looking at it was, it kind of reminded me of a smaller DFTC, in that there was your cadet school, artillery school, the infantry school, you had your headquarters, you had your CID training. So there was like a lot of different aspects to it. So it wasn't just that. And while we were out there as well, in 2019, the Malian Armed Forces got a new fleet of Caspers. So it was an armoured personnel carriers that were given to them by the German army.
Yeah, they came from South Africa.
Yeah, so they're a South African vehicle that was refurbished and given to the Malian Armed Forces. And that was one of the courses that we had instructed on. I suppose it's drawn from our own experiences, given that we would have had carrier commanders courses done going to previous missions. So there was a lot of hours put into those courses, and there was the tactical side of it. So like the Malians themselves, probably, I suppose the background is, some of them would never have driven a car, let alone an armoured car. Yeah. So like they had to be, you know, taught the very basics so like going into the tactical ops side of it, and that kind of side.
Yeah, that Caspier course would have been the first 2 weeks, the drivers would have been separate. Getting taught how to drive these big armoured vehicles that they would never have seen before. Yeah. Probably. And we would have been working with the soldiers doing counter ID stuff. And
okay, well, I suppose we can kind of go into a bit of detail in like the different types of courses we were delivering before, as we go along. Just the Irish contingent out there as well. So what is the makeup like? As in, broadly speaking, where are people based and what are their various roles? There's obviously the trainer aspect, which is what you were doing, but what other aspects are we doing out there?
The full contingent is 20. So we had 9 in the HQ element in Bamako. Myself and Valerie were in the in Kulikura on the training site, so there was 11 of us there.
So two locations.
Two locations, So about an hour and ten minutes.
About an hour and a
Yeah.
And obviously, for people at home, the Irish Defence Forces also has a number of personnel involved in the MINUSMA mission, which is a UN mission operating in Mali. But in this case, we're talking specifically about the European Union training mission. So two locations, Bamako and Kulikura training camp.
Yeah, so I suppose the Kulikura side, it's the training side of it, but we had our lieutenant colonel, and then our commandant was, say, the SO of the S7 side of the house, so he looked after all the training. Yeah. Then we had the S4, so it was the guys in the signals logistics. And then we had, obviously, ourselves, the trainers as well. So there was different elements to it, but a small little group of us, but we were playing different roles within the training area itself.
Yeah, exactly. And all contributing to making the kind of mission work away.
Exactly,
the main
yeah.
point is the training, and to support the training.
Exactly.
It's occurring out in Kulikura.
The lieutenant colonel, he was the executive officer for the camp, so quite an important role over there as well. And then as the commandant, he was like head of all the training, or like deputy.
Deputy chief instructor.
Yeah, so what course are coming up. So two very important roles in the camp itself,
so
big influence in the camp, like
integral roles to the mission. I mean, that's good to hear that Defence Forces personnel are having such a direct influence on how the training is conducted out there, and who and what has decided how the training as a whole, not just the actual on the ground side of it as well. So you mentioned earlier, Valerie, that like the camp itself reminded you like of a small Defence Forces training centre, a small DFTC. So can I go into that in a little more detail for us? So
okay.
I would have understood that going over there, our personnel are primarily kind of running infantry-based courses. But from what I've heard from you, it's actually much more varied than that.
Yeah, yeah. So like the camp itself, it's a small enough camp, like a size of a small village, and it was secured by the force protection. So while we were there, the force protection was made up of the Spanish contingent and the Czech Republic contingent. So they were in charge of the whole security of the compound. Within the compound, then you'd have the different locations where the different courses will go on. So the likes of the infantry courses, that this was one of the first courses that we actually instructed on. So the infantry course itself, you could have a company of 100 personnel on it, and then within that company it's broken down into smaller platoons and sections. So that course went on for 6 weeks.
I think so, yeah.
About 6 weeks training.
We were shadowing just to get our feet, just to kind of see how the Malians
worked
and how the other trainers, because we would have been the freshest ones.
Yeah, exactly.
So, so with the likes of the infantry corps, similar to at home, so like in the morning time, they'd have their parade and then we'd go down to the stores. So they'd draw their weapons. So the weapons that they were using was the AK-47. And prior to deployment, we would have had training on the AK-47. So we were familiar with giving instruction, obviously, to the Malian armed forces. So they draw their weapons. Not everybody will get a weapon because of the whole logistical side of it. Say 80% of the platoon might have an AK and somebody else might have a wooden version of it. Just, and again, that's just down to their own logistics side of it.
Shortages, yeah. And bits and pieces like that.
But so from there, then we'd go out into the training area. So you'd book a training area like you would at home, and you would take the platoon out there and you'd spend the day out there training with them on different tactics and stuff. And then you come in for lunchtime. So again, it's very similar kind of routine as it would be at home.
So there's obviously the infantry part that we were discussing and the kind of basic kind of tactical stuff. But your other skills that you would have accrued over your military career here in Ireland were also used out there. Like, for example, you were instructing, as you mentioned, on those armoured personnel carriers, is that right?
Yeah, so prior to deploying to Hundaff in 2017, we would have done a car commander's course. Mm-hmm. So we would have been working with the cars. So again, just the likes of car dismount drills and your technical procedures when you do dismount and that kind of thing. So that was one of the courses. And then, I suppose, amphibian instructor as well. So they would have done a lot of
fighting built areas, the urban warfare. Yeah.
So the urban operation. So like there was a village there that was used specifically for that. It was a village that was, you know, the story, it was built for...
Built for the officers, but there's a Mount Cade just beside the camp. The Malians believe it's haunted, so they never occupied the houses. So
that, as I mentioned, I was actually out there myself briefly for a media trip in there. So these were houses that were originally built for Malian officers that would have been serving the camp.
Yeah.
What they are now, they're basically kind of shells of buildings.
Yeah, there's no windows or doors, but they use it to move through rooms and so on. Yeah.
Like a mini Fort Davis or such. Yeah. So they're able to, and that was beside the camp, so there was that kind of aspect of it as well. And then there was the topography course, so that was like their map reading and navigation, which was very interesting because these guys, sometimes, like, we produced all the maps and the map reading equipment and all that kind of stuff for them. So it was learning the basics on how to read a map to do night navigations. So we did night navigation exercises with them out in the training area, which to them, they were let out in pairs. There was force protection out there to make sure that everyone, I suppose, was safe. And we give them GPSs. So again, this was equipment that EUTM was able to supply to the Malians to teach them how to use this kind of equipment. And also they were able to use your Silva compass. So it was the two aspects. So it was the basic right up to using a GPS. So their skills, like, throughout their courses would have developed, and they were very good, like, with picking things up and, you know, learning quickly. Like, they were very, very interested the whole time. So, like, whenever we had a course, it was like they were very enthusiastic, and I suppose really happy to be there, because I suppose the more time they spent in the Coolagura training area, the less time they were spending up the north, I suppose.
Yeah.
So yeah, they were happy to be there. They wanted to be there, and teaching them was really kind of rewarding, because you were able to see the end product, where they were able, from going not knowing basically what way to turn a map to being able to navigate at night time.
Yeah, so obviously in the same way at home, we did a podcast recently enough with Sergeant Rico Lucchese of the 27th Battalion, and he mentioned the satisfaction of seeing that product of people picking up training and seeing them develop. And I'm sure you probably got the same satisfaction dealing with the Malian soldiers and the Malian recruits out there as they kind of moved along. For your for yourself, Ozzy, you mentioned that you went further up. You went up towards Sigur, the north.
Yeah, so it was just 6 hours north of Kulikoro.
Mm-hmm.
So we drove up. There's a kind of a dual carriageway, kind of modern enough road. So it would have been a SEMA, which is a combined military advisory training team.
Mm-hmm.
So in that you'd have your trainers, you'd have force protection, you'd have the medical aspect and the logistics side of it. So we went up a German couple, I don't know the backstory, but they own a hotel on the River Niger in Segou. Force protection went up a week ahead, so they took over the hotel and secured it. Then we came up and we worked with the local we went to the local camp essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And did a remote kind of training camp there for 4 weeks. With myself, Sergeant Horgan and Sergeant Jacob, and there was 17 other trainers, I think. So we just went to the camp every day, did kind of a infantry course, essentially. Yeah. So you'd be, at all times during training, you'd be very aware that everything you're teaching them, they're going to be using these skills and drills in real life. When we were in Segou, I think it was the middle of the week two, a camp as part of this brigade was attacked. And one of the guys in the platoon we were teaching, his brother was killed. So, and you know, they still came to work the next day, the whole company or platoon we were training. But like, they had a real appreciation of, you know, their job was very serious. So you as a trainer, like, you have to, you had to be able to teach them exactly what to do. And the IPs, again, I was probably touching that later on, but the IPs would translate what you're teaching them across.
The interpreters,
big brand. And like, you'd have to be very conscious that what you're teaching them is going to be used by them.
Which brings it home, this is real world, real life consequences, and you have a responsibility to make sure these people are trained as best as you can.
Absolutely, yeah. And then, like, as Lieutenant Doyle was saying there, like, initially before we went over, we were told, obviously, the Malian Armed Forces, their primary language is French, and then their local language will be
Bambara.
So with that, like, none of us really knew much French, but we had interpreters, which was great because the interpreters were excellent at English. But I suppose a lot of what we did was visual. So the likes of your TTPs or your tactics at all that you were doing out in the ground, we'd create like a model so that they could visualize where their section is, where they're going to move to, and how they're going to move through it. And then obviously if there was any questions from the class or from the platoon, it would go through the interpreter. But what we did was we picked up a few words here and there, and I think they loved that when you made an effort to speak their language or to say a couple of words in Bambara or in French. It really, like, you know, got them kind of, I suppose, clued in a bit more.
Got them interested.
More interested, yeah. So it was good. We had the use of the interpreter. So there was never really like a language barrier or a communication barrier in that sense. And especially with the other nations as well. So you had the Spanish, and I suppose everybody was from different countries, but everybody spoke English. So that was the primary language was English into.
I suppose in terms of other courses we worked on, then during a quiet period, I ran a train the trainers course, speaking or teach English to the other trainers on the mission. Now, a few people at home probably say I don't speak English, but I was more than qualified, according to come teaching English class over there. So that was an interesting side as well.
Yeah.
You're actually, not only were we trying to improve the Malians, but trying to improve the mission as well and what products we were delivering to them, because we did do our own counter ID course, where we built a sand pit, and the Moldovans, who were the specialists at IEDs, would kind of upskill us as trainers as well. So that was good. It was always...
So there's always a kind of just a continuous learning aspect to the camp, both for the Malians and for yourselves and for the other contingents too as well.
Yeah. And one of the other sergeants that was over with us as well, Sergeant Rory Jacob, he was the subject matter expert with the CIED, so he was heavily involved with building the IED pit, and like was, I suppose, involved with developing that syllabus as well. So it was really good in that he had a good input into, I suppose, teaching the Malians, because it would be something that's very current now in every mission, like not just Mali but across the world, is the IEDs.
Of course, yeah.
And to kind of train them on that and keep everything very current.
The counter improvised explosive device aspect of it, you would think it was so huge in Afghanistan, and it's become a huge part of our own training at home here as well. It's also good to hear that it's not just the very basic stuff that's being taught. It's ground up, and it's also, these are things that you need to look out for in the modern world and in the modern security situation or a battlefield.
Yeah, myself, yourself and Sergeant Horgan, Mick Horgan would have done the pedagogy course as well, so something like our specialised instructor course here.
Yeah.
So we ran that for the trainers in the camp as well. And then when I went to school, went to the NCO training school. So what I'm doing at home, I suppose, in Mali, so that was kind of interesting. And seeing their senior NCOs from a different brigade as well.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And kind of, getting that sort of level of contact with them. And later on in the podcast, I want to go into sort of the contact that you had with, say, the Malian officers and Malian NCOs and how they're kind of upskilling. You also instructed police as well in Segou?
In Bamako.
On Bamako?
Yeah, so myself and Sergeant Mick Horgan went into to Bamako for a week and we trained the Malians. Myself and Mick ran a range day for them, sort of a combat shooting. Sergeant Horgan was very experienced with that.
Yeah.
But we also did phibia drills for, again, fighting in built-up areas, big burn. Drills for 2 days with them. But yeah, it was interesting just to work with other than the FAMA the military over there, working with a special branch of the police that would work with their government.
Yeah, kind of paramilitary style branch, yeah.
Kind of, yeah. So it was just something we got out of the camp for a week and just working with different types of troops as well. That was interesting.
To go into the people that you were actually training, the Malian soldiers themselves that were coming in, like, obviously there's a big culture, there's a cultural difference, which we'll talk about. But who were they in? Like, were they from the southern part of Mali, or were they from all over? Or
Generally, the troops would come from all over Mali. So they'd be down there Monday to Friday, and then the weekends to go home themselves.
Yeah.
Demographic, mostly young. There was some older ones, but this was the average age. Well, you were saying there was one or two didn't know their age, just kind of whatever.
Their background, they didn't have any.
Because you'd say they'd come from orphanages or from.
Yeah, so there was one guy in particular I remember. He was like the oldest guy in the company, and they used to tell us that he didn't know what age he was because he didn't have a birth cert or he was an orphan. So they guessed that he was about 50, maybe mid-50s.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like the majority of them probably range between 20 and maybe 30.
Yeah.
So like in between, between 20 and 30. So there was a good range of them, of, I suppose, different backgrounds and that. And the majority of them, as Lieutenant Doyle was saying, they would travel from all over and they would come down for the week.
Yeah.
And they'd stay in the camp outside of our camp, which was specific for them. They had their own accommodation there and they had their own cooking facilities and they had their own security aspect out there as well. So, and then it was a normal course Monday to Friday and then they'd go home the weekends. So I suppose similar to courses ourselves that we do run at home as well.
In terms of our interaction then, as you mentioned, maybe the IPs that would work with them. Like, obviously they're culturally different than us.
Yes.
Very, very friendly. Love the Europeans. A big thing, I suppose, we were told before we got over, like when they want to talk to you, they'll hold your hand. You know, and you know, it's not something you're used to hear, but like, you know, just come up, they'll hold your hand.
Or, yeah.
That's how they engage you. That's how they'll hold your hand. They'll look you straight in the eye and have a conversation with you. So the IPs are the interpreters that do the same as well.
Yeah.
So I suppose the first day we were out there, that probably
took it by surprise slightly, even though
you just get used to that after a while. But like very like. Whatever you asked them to do, they were always happy to do it. Like they saw the benefit of you being there to them.
They were a very positive attitude.
Yeah.
They obviously had different levels of education, and we spoke about backgrounds. But like, how was coming in? Like, how have they ended up in the Malian Armed Forces, or is it just is it seen as prestigious over there, or is it seen?
I suppose to have a job in Mali is a positive. So the army will be seen as a. While it be a dangerous job, it is a secure job. You know, they're given accommodation and they're fed. From what we saw in the camp we were in, whenever they go north, I suppose it might be a bit different. To be in the military was they're respected enough.
Yeah, of course.
I suppose, sorry, like a lot of them would have probably family members that would have been in the army, so they were following in either their father's or uncle's footsteps. And I suppose what we did see on the other side of it, the cadet school side of it, was a lot of them would have been, had their fathers served in the Malian Armed Forces as well. And a couple of times now, I would have done physical training with the cadet school on a Wednesday morning at 6 o'clock. And there was one morning where there was seven pilots who had had to go through their cadetship, same as everybody else. But they had been to university in France and different countries across the EU. And these guys were, their education was excellent. They had third level education. They had they were fluent in English, so there was no problems there. So it just goes to show there was completely different levels of education from, say, the infantry courses right up to, say, the officer training side of it, where they had already experienced different training outside of Mali, which was, I suppose, good experience for them.
Yeah, yeah. And the Malian Armed Force, is that open to everybody in the country, as in within certain ages? It's open to, like, both genders? It's open to...
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
So I suppose, like most European armies in that, the ratio would be, I suppose, like, obviously there's a lot more male in it, but there was also females that would have taken part in a lot of the courses as well. And also there would have been some female instructors in the cadet school in there as well. So there was, I suppose, like, I don't know, there could have been maybe 5-10% females in the
seemed
course.
Higher in the cadet school.
It
as well.
Did, yeah, yeah. There's a lot more in the cadet school. Yeah. But yeah, there was still a percentage of females there, yeah.
And as regards just generally, like, these kind of Malian soldiers that were coming in, how did they take to the country? You said their attitude was all very positive, but and the language barrier wasn't too big a thing, but, like, how did they take to the kind of training that you were offering?
Yeah, I suppose because the mission was going since 2013, there were, whoever had been back for a course knew how it operated, so generally you start training at 8 in the morning till 12. I suppose they, as Val said earlier, they kind of learn more by visualising things, or you having a model and drawing out where they are, where their comrades are, why they're moving in certain ways. So they'd learn way better by doing things.
Yeah.
As opposed to you writing a lot of things on the whiteboard you could bring out.
I suppose at varying education levels like that, you know, I mean, if you're not used to that kind of thing, it wouldn't hold your attention.
No, so what we found was you'd get a good attention span for about 10 minutes. So they'd be paying attention and then you could see them starting to drift. So that's when we knew, change things up or add in the element of competition or something like that, especially if it was weapons handling. We used to do a lot of weapons handling with the basic kind of infantry course, and we'd have, like, you know, the weapon stripping and assembling the weapons, add in a bit of competition, blindfold them or race them and that kind of thing. And that, like, they're learning at the same time, but they're competing against each other. And for some reason, they just loved competition.
Yeah.
And they always wanted to know who won. And if I won, what do I get? Do I get, like, 10 minutes off here, or do I get something? And we used to give them, like, small little prizes and stuff to kind of, you know, add in that little bit of excitement for them as well. Like, so no more than at home. I mean, everybody loves a bit of competition. And it does.
They responded very well.
They did, yeah. Yeah, so... You'd get a bit of crack out of them as well.
Yeah.
And it made it more enjoyable for us. And then you could see at the end of the day how much they've performed.
Yeah.
But I suppose the best time to train them was in the morning time when they were more alert. Obviously, the weather over there,
exactly, yeah,
it was just so hot. Like, I think the hottest time we clocked was about 50 degrees out in the training area. Mm. And, like, we'd have body armor, assault vest. You're carrying your long barrel. You have your pistol. You have all the gear with you. So it can be quite, I suppose, physically demanding as well. Like, so... But for them, when we used to see, when we give them a break out in the training area, they go straight for underneath the vehicles where there was a bit of shelter. And
you'd
see, like, you're thinking, Jesus, if they're finding this hot, like, we're standing here, like, used to Irish weather out in the middle of Mali. So,
you're kind of, maybe we should take a leaf out of the locals' book, because then they obviously know something.
Yeah. Exactly,
maybe we don't, and get a bit of shelter. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, towards the evening time, like, they were getting tired. And, like, obviously, their nutrition wouldn't have been as good as ours, so they probably would have got a bowl of rice or something at lunchtime. So that wouldn't really sustain them as much as us. So we kind of had to, you know, we were aware of that, and we, you know, you couldn't overtrain them either, because, you know, it wasn't fair on them. So we trained them as best we could for as long as we could, and then give them breaks.
Mm-hmm.
So that was how we got the best out of them.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask, just regarding, you mentioned earlier, Valerie, about, like, some of them would have AK-47s, some of them would have like a wooden cutlass. So there were equipment shortages to deal with as well.
Yeah. So again, their logistics, like, because there were so many of them, so the likes of, we'd be used to getting our supply of pyrotechnics, so the likes of our blank rounds, our smoke grenades and all that kind of stuff, for making exercise at home that little bit more realistic. So while we were out in the training area, to make it more realistic, they didn't have access to blank ammunition or smoke grenades and stuff like that. It was very, very limited to certain exercises. So instead of firing blank ammunition, they would mimic it. They'd be shouting at each other and that kind of stuff. Yeah,
they'd have rapid fire.
Rapid fire and they'd be like making noises of weapons and that kind of stuff. And I suppose, look, it was
just trying to get the atmosphere going and make it a bit more kinetic for it. Yeah.
So then when we did have pyros, there was a couple of times where we did have smoke grenades and stuff. And when we throw smoke out, like, just that added a little bit of realism to them as well. So it kind of made them perform a bit more. So.
The German trainers are very good for getting smoke grenades and stuff like that. The Germans brought a lot to the mission. Like.
Yeah.
So they would...
Fantastic. As regards their conditions as well. So you mentioned that at lunch they might only get a bowl of rice. Like, their barracks and where they were actually staying, the conditions were extremely basic.
Yeah, so they had a cookhouse. So when I say cookhouse, it was like a shed that you'd have cattle in, but it had like two fires going with two massive pots over it, and they'd have the local women cooking boiling rice and stuff like that for them. So they would literally get their break, go over to the shed, get their food. So hygiene, sanitation, all that was kind of out the window. So it was very, very, you know, I suppose limited to what they had, unfortunately, but they were still able to, you know, continue with their training and that kind of thing. But but like if we had any stuff at all, we'd give it to them. You know, we'd bring out
bottles of water
and stuff like that. Yeah. As well, like. Yeah.
And we talked as well about their sleeping conditions. So that's their cookhouse conditions you mentioned and where they're getting their food, but their sleeping conditions are also very basic.
Yeah, so across from their cookhouse, they had a smaller camp just outside our camp, and there was accommodation for maybe up to 300 troops. And there were small little buildings with a tin roof on it. So you can imagine how the heat during the day would have been like probably going into a sauna. So when they got their siesta at lunchtime, they would pull their beds outside under a tree and they would sleep there. And probably during the night as well, because it just got so hot. And there could have been up to, I suppose, 20 in one of these small little buildings. So if you can imagine, a billet in the Glen of Amal would hold probably up to, well, the biggest one would hold probably 16. So their buildings were a lot smaller than that with more people in it. So it was a lot more condensed.
Yeah.
They had their own security there as well. Now, it wouldn't have been, I suppose, as secure as our camp, but they did have an element of security there. So it was very kind of, if there was a lot of training going on at the same time, it would be very, be busy enough in their little accommodation thing.
Yeah,
so.
Be quite cramped.
Yeah, very cramped.
And as regards, obviously, training in Ireland and recruit courses and things, there's a military socialisation aspect where the NCOs and officer staff will go down, the instructor staff will go down and they'll, you know, check on, you know, have a room inspection on, because that wasn't part of the type of training you were doing with them.
No,
it was just in the field instruction is what your job was.
Yeah, just the basic infantry skills. So nothing down, so they had their own parades and inspections. So they'd have a platoon commander, platoon sergeant, and they'd inspect them like in the morning to make sure that they had their boots on and they had all their equipment that they were given as well. But actually, we were just talking about equipment. I remember one day there was a resupply of equipment when they got the Caspiers out. They got helmets, body armor, and they got new boots. So that was all supplied by the German army. So, you know, like they were getting good equipment in that, you know, that was theirs to keep. And then they were made sure but then there was other aspects of it that they didn't.
And I suppose when there's a rotation of troops in and out, the troops that have received equipment in that occasion go, and then the next troops come in and
they mightn't get any.
Exactly. So there's not a kind of an even equipment or equipping of the manning armed forces in the way that when there's a new issue brought into, say, our own defence forces or into
everybody gets it.
Everybody does get it. It's sort of more piecemeal, more ad hoc kind of.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that was the way it was. But in fairness, like there was a visit actually while we were there from the J4 in the German army, and they were over, I suppose, looking at the likes of the equipment that they would have given, particularly the Caspiers and the different kind of equipment that they would have given, which was good, I suppose, for the Malian army.
Yeah, of course, yeah. To do a little inspection and see how it's going.
Yeah.
We mentioned, say, those guys that received new equipment and then they'd rotate out. So after troops had received their course of training in Coolacre Road Training Camp, what happens then typically to them?
Well, it depends where they came from originally, but I suppose they'll get deployed back to their local brigade, whether that be north, west, east, south, or whatever. I suppose the majority of ones we train seem to go north, back towards Ségou or Timbuktu, kind of that direction. So it'd be, depending on when the course ended, or the course might end early, they'd find out they're deploying north or wherever. on the Monday. So that we'd have a closing ceremony. The students got a certificate, which they like to get, because you know, you might obviously can't show your skills yet, but you had a printout from the European mission.
Yeah,
they love to hang it up on their wall at home. So that was a big thing, that they always got this cert at the end with their name on it.
Yeah,
and that was the physical thing they got at the end of the course, and off they went back under the controller, company commander, whatever again.
And could very quickly end up on operations, basically in combat.
Yeah.
In North Mountain.
Usually a very short turnaround that.
Yeah.
From what we understood it to be anyway.
Yeah. And did you ever pick up from talking to them what their feelings on that were or how they viewed it?
I know the one that stands out for me was the Caspier one.
Yeah.
Where it ended early. I think they were told on the Thursday or Friday that they were deploying in the Monday rather than staying the next 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Could see the morale was low on Friday.
It was, correct me if I'm wrong on this now, but I remember they were told by their company commander, the Malian company commander had told them, and they weren't happy obviously at first. But whatever obviously he was speaking Bamber to them, so we didn't
understand. Remember that,
But by the end of whatever he said, they were actually all cheering and delighted to go. So I suppose, look, that's what they joined the military to do. They want their country as stable as we wanted their country to be back stable, and as they know pre-2012.
So I mean, there's an element of, I mean, they are protecting their own nation,
their families, their friends, such. And so on.
And over the course of the time that she spent, the mission that she spent, the 6 months that she spent in the mission, how many Malian soldiers do you reckon passed through your actually E trained, do you reckon?
I'd say about 350.
Yeah, about 300. That. So we would have instructed probably on between 4 or 5 courses each. So between the infantry courses, the map reading courses, the instructor courses, then you did the CMAT as well. So yeah, like for each infantry course, there would have been a company on it. So you're talking about 100 personnel. So if we did 4 of them, yeah, you're talking about, I suppose, around the 300-400 mark we would have seen pass through while we were there.
Yeah.
And then I suppose the...
There would have been sharpshooter courses, TAC-B courses that we didn't work on as well. Yeah. So there would have been far more than that going through the camp.
So there's a very high turnover of Malian troops going through there. So most, would be fair to say that most of the Malian Armed Forces have at some point received some training from Western military.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely they would have. Yeah.
And some had been back for a second course now, but I think that was rare enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Because actually it was funny, some of them actually would ask us, do you know such and such?
That's right, yeah.
Because like they'd be like, so the guys that were there before us on the say for the first, second, third mission, we were the 13th Irish contingent over there. So obviously there was a lot of Irish before us, and some of them would say, do you know CS such and such? And we'd say, yeah, we know. And we go, oh yeah, I met him in 2014.
The IPs, particularly the IPs, would have a great relationship.
They'd obviously be staying there, they wouldn't be rotating out.
But then some of the actual soldiers had been back for a second time to do a different course or something like that, and they would have remembered some of the characters that would have come from the Irish contingents. It was funny to see that, but
I suppose there's that kind of memory on it. There's a big turnover. Lots of Malian troops have received instruction from not only Irish but from other European armies. Had you much dealings with the Malian officers, the Malian non-commissioned officers, the leadership element of the Malian army?
We would on some course, the Caspier certainly, because that was a company level course.
Yeah.
So where we were doing the dismount and stuff, the senior NCOs or officers would have been. Dominique was the German captain, and he would have been doing kind of more leadership stuff, or
it was like a senior command and staff course.
So there's no, Dominique wasn't part of the ATF, which they do advisory stuff. So that was like the senior command and staff course.
Okay,
but they would have came out later on the course like that on the bigger courses, but as like the ATF worked in Bamako. And they would have worked in the HQ element of FAMA.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have been in Kulikoro, but they would have came on CMATs, because obviously there would have been officers and so on in the brigade you're going to on those CMATs. But like on some of the courses, like the top or the map reading course, you would have had some NCOs on that course.
Yeah, so the map reading course, it was like an instructor course for them. So it was all NCOs, senior NCOs, and some officers as well. But then the basic map reading course, and then you had the instructor course as well. So the likes of that is a little bit more advanced for them, and they would have done the basic, they would have went from the basic then on to the instructor, some of them. Yeah.
The specialised instructor course then, that would have been senior NCOs on that.
Yeah.
But certainly this amount of stuff, that was generally non-officers or non-senior NCOs.
So the specialised instructor course would have been a mirror of the course that we do here to prepare
officers
and NCOs for instructing.
So a lot of the syllabus we actually taught over there would have been very, very similar to what we do here.
We would have implemented that over there. So like our Commandant Tynan, he was in the training cell, so he would have offered, say, courses to the Malian commander, and he would have agreed to it. So he would have said, okay, we can run a specialised instructor's course. And we ran that, and they loved it, and they thought it was really good. So we condensed it down to what time period that they would say, okay, we've 2 weeks to do this, can you run this course? And then we would, I suppose, extract from our own syllabus and then create a new syllabus for EUTM. And then that was there then for future. So anybody that was coming over, say from different EU countries, they could look at the syllabus and then deliver the instructions like we would.
Like the lesson plans and everything would be available to all the trainers.
Okay. So just kind of, at the end, from your perspectives, like, I mean, do you feel that what you were doing out there was making a real difference to those Malian soldiers that you met and that you trained?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I suppose, again, probably you're going to be sick of hearing about this Caspier course, but at the end of every course, you'd run a big exercise. And generally, like, the commandant would come out, or the chief instructor come out, and he'd watch them, and you'd see the students executing the skills and so on. Like,
yeah.
So that was really good. It was, you're confirming that the students, be driving three Caspers down the road, we simulate contact left, the smoke grenade out there. They have turrets, so the lads up in the turret would get up, and it was in the train area close camp, so it'd be blank ammunition. They'd react, the lads would dismount, form baseline, move onto the target or move away, extract out the area. I gave them casualties, they deal with the casualties, stuff like that. So like when you did exercise at that, you're like, okay, these lads are, you know, they're not the soldier that turned up here 6 or 8 weeks ago.
Yeah.
You're more confident in their abilities. And I suppose it was satisfying enough taking them in at start and seeing that product at the end as well. And then no more with the map reading as well, I'm sure, night navigation and stuff.
Because I remember looking at the syllabus and the different lesson plans and thinking, my God, how are these guys going to like do a night nav? They don't know the right way around the map. But after the 4 weeks, like 4 weeks of basic training, and just bring them along and showing them how you actually do it from A to B, to sending them out into a training area like 10 kilometers out and back in the middle of the night, it was really good. Like they all came back, thank God, and nobody got lost and we weren't in trouble. But no, there was really good to actually see that, and then I suppose like it shows that they're really good at picking things up. They want to learn, they want to get these new skills, and it's an opportunity for them to develop themselves as well, and then to be able to relay it onto the guys coming up after them as well. Like, so it was definitely very, very good for us to kind of see that.
Yeah, like, and again, going back to what I said earlier, like you really do get appreciation that they probably will use these skills that you teach them as well. Like,
yeah.
I remember the first day we were on the court, we were doing counter AED stuff, and I just posed a question to the whole platoon at the time. How many of them had been in a convoy that had hit an IED or were, you know, had seen one, and 2/3 of them had some.
It's quite high.
They knew.
So that really brings it home to you.
Yeah. So like they knew, they were well aware of what you were trying to teach them or why you were trying to teach the thing. You didn't really have to emphasize.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have to give them stats. These guys had seen it.
Wow.
So they were like, even as the Lieutenant Oil was saying, when they were doing 5s and 25s, like you want to see how cautious they were, like moving around the vehicle and actually doing it. Because they know that if they don't cover certain parts of ground, that ground's not covered. It could be their buddy there behind them that's getting the news.
Yeah, it's getting killed or severely injured by
the force. So it was very, I suppose, what they were doing was they were being focused that I need to learn this because it's going to save my life.
Yeah. Well, at the end of that, thanks very much, Valerie and Ozzy, for coming on to the show and sharing your experiences.
Well, you're welcome, sir.
Pleasure.
Very enjoyable.
I think like you provided us with a really good insight into what Irish troops are doing in EUTM Mali and the importance of the mission to stabilising the region. So it's great. It's great to hear. For further information on the Irish Defence Forces, check out our social media platforms and military.ie. Serving members are also encouraged to check out the members area of military.ie. Today's episode was produced by Corporal Keith Harrison and Sergeant Paul Keeley of the Defence Forces Audiovisual School. The Irish Defence Forces podcast is available for download on Spotify, iTunes, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back soon with a new episode. For everyone out there, thanks for listening and stay safe.